Throughout this episode of Morally Indefensible, you'll hear dramatic recreations of the correspondence between Joe McGinnis and Jeffrey McDonald, taken from letters and transcripts of tapes. It was 1982, 3 years after Dr. Jeffrey McDonald was convicted of murdering his family and sent to prison. Writer Joe McGinnis was racing to finish his much-anticipated book about the case, and it wasn't going very well.
Dear Jeff, the crunch of all crunches is upon me. The next 4 weeks will be hellish.
While Joe was searching for the perfect ending for his book, his publisher was losing patience. There would be no more money until Joe delivered. Joe was going into debt.
Jeff, one of the reasons it's taking so long is that I am in the position of trying to catch up with a story which continues to unfold.
Meanwhile, from his prison cell, Jeff was writing to Joe with some important updates about his case.
Joe, I think the enclosed is incredible news. I think it may turn out to be critical.
According to Jeff, his new legal team had discovered some startling new evidence about the hippies Jeff said attacked him and his family.
It does, for the first time, begin to build a viable case against the real intruders. I think I can still fight back.
And Joe seemed to agree.
Jeff, I tell people, it's my guess, that you will receive a new trial. Needless to say, a new trial would be the best possible thing for the book because of all the publicity it would generate. Depending on timing, I might have to work in a new ending.
The idea that Joe's book would end with the real killers gave Jeff hope. This new book would announce to the world that Jeffrey McDonald was wrongfully convicted. Jeff would get his life back. So to get Joe everything he needed, Jeff asked his new attorney, Brian O'Neill, to give him a call.
He just thought Joe McGinnis was the cat's pajamas, and he's really raving about him. He's looking out, he's my pal, and all that.
I'm Brian O'Neill, I'm the lawyer.
So I did call him. Probably spoke for an hour and a half on the phone.
I'm on to something. Gotta trust my gut on these things.
He was very nice, very ingratiating guy.
By somebody other than Jeff McDonald.
And of course, he's a journalist. He could really bullshit with the best of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Good to meet you.
There was just something about our exchange. I didn't trust him.
McDonald told military police the murderers were three men and a woman who invaded his family quarters.
She's saying, acid is groovy, kill the pigs.
I had just seen a woman two blocks away.
Dr. Jeffrey McDonald was found guilty today of murdering his wife and two children.
Not to mention the fact that the perpetrators of the crime are still free.
Absolutely. There are at least four people running around who have murdered three people.
Three consecutive life sentences.
Total strangers can see within 5 minutes that you did not receive a fair trial.
I've just sort of been getting a whole sense of positive vibes about the appeal. I think that this is the stage now that they are going to reverse this.
I don't have to convince you that you ought to be out, but what do your lawyers say?
I'm Mark Smerling, and this is Morally Indefensible. Chapter 4, The Confessions. When lawyer Brian O'Neill first took on Jeffrey McDonald's appeal, Jeff was running out of options. To get a new trial, he needed to introduce new evidence. So Brian hired a private detective.
Ray Shedlick was, he was from Queens. Spoke like he was from Queens. Looked like he was from Queens. Cigarette smoke like a halo. Really smart. Not fancy smart, but really could figure things out. He was really a very good investigator.
I had some trepidation. First of all, I believed almost intently that Dr. McDonald was guilty of these homicides.
Shedlick was a retired NYPD detective. He died in 1989, but we've got this interview from decades ago. And like almost everybody back then, he'd heard about the McDonald murders.
I told Brian O'Neill, I told Dr. McDonald ultimately, that I would conduct his investigation independently. No matter where the chips fell, I would tell him exactly what I had found. So it is from that point that I've commenced my investigation into the McDonald homicides.
Jeff described his attackers as two white men, a black man, and a blonde woman in a floppy hat. Shedlick wanted to know if anyone else had seen those people that night, so he placed an ad in a local newspaper.
And it wasn't very long after that that I began to receive telephone calls.
A lot of calls.
His eyes looked a little hollow, slightly dazed. He said he was partly responsible for the McDonald slayings.
He confessed that he'd murdered people. He was asking for God's forgiveness.
And one name kept popping up.
Greg Mitchell.
Gregory Mitchell.
Greg Mitchell said, let's get on with it. Then they took off in the direction of Fort Bragg.
Over the years, even more people came forward with stories of a man confessing to murder.
This was a long time ago, but it was something you would remember because of the situation and what happened with the murders.
That's Christine Griffin. In the early 80s, she and her husband John were at their lake house in South Carolina trying to install a new high-end computer system.
And computers, you know, weren't the size of your briefcase then. They were the size of a Volkswagen and took a lot more power. So we had to find somebody, an electrician type, that would come in and jack up the power for it.
The Griffins heard about an electrician named Greg Mitchell. The day Greg showed up to give an estimate, he took one look at the lake.
And he said he'd do it really cheap if he could bring his friends out, you know, and have them play in the lake. And we said, gosh, that sounds like a deal.
So the night Greg finished his work, he and his friends went for a swim. Afterward, the drinking started. The Griffins joined the party in their boathouse.
Little did we know they would stay and drink and drink.
And I think they were all pretty much hooked on drugs.
Greg was very dramatic when he talked, used his hands and head, and almost talked like a salesperson the whole time he was saying something. What's he selling? What's he selling? So that's how it started. We're just sitting at the bar talking. He kept saying all through the evening, I've done something.
I've done something so bad.
So awful. Well, I'm going to find out what he's done so awful that you're not talking about.
Chris can get it out of you.
As the evening went on, he's drunk and he's putting his head down on the bar and he's boo-hooing and crying and going on.
Well, I killed some people.
It got our attention then.
The drunker he got, the more guilty and bad that he felt.
He said, you remember that Dr. McDonald? He talked about the children, those precious little children, about how he could have done that he didn't know or something. He was just crazy.
There's no argument about what he said. The McDonald murders, we did it.
Have you ever felt like escaping to your own desert island? Jane Gaskin did exactly that, trading in the family home to begin a new life in the tropics. But she soon discovers that paradise has its secrets. I'm Alice Levine, and this is The Price of Paradise, the island dream that ends in kidnap, corruption, and murder. Wish you were here? Follow The Price of Paradise now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Everett W. Morse. Grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina. Lived there all of my life, other than the time I was in military service.
In the early 70s, Everett Morse was a student at the University of North Carolina. He went there to study, drink a little beer, and occasionally play some golf.
Four.
and you had a neighbor.
Yeah, Greg, referring to Greg Mitchell, he was a relatively small build, thin, blonde hair, if you will, with a mustache. Probably, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, somewhere along in there. Greg was probably the only person that was not in college at that time. We knew he did a lot of drugs because he offered to get us drugs. And none of us did drugs. We just drank beer.
One day, Greg invited Everett to his apartment.
Said he had a present for me, so I went over there. There was 9 or 10 cats in that small apartment. I had observed guns and knives in his apartment on numerous occasions. There were pills, powders, people in and out, and there was a case of golf balls. And he said,
"Do you want them?"
I said, "Well, I don't have any money, Greg. I'm a college kid trying to make it." He got mad, and I just finally started to leave, and he became very, very angry to where I was looking in his face and his eyes, and I was not very comfortable in what I was seeing. And then he said, "You take these or I'll
kill you like I did McDonald."
His eyes were fire burning. I didn't think anything about it, to tell you the truth, what he was talking about. I didn't know if he was talking about, you know, old McDonald.
Jeff's new lawyer, Brian O'Neill, wanted to know who Greg Mitchell was. So he dug up a photograph of Greg when he was a soldier in Vietnam.
He's standing here and the other guy's standing here, human ears. These guys had, you know, taken people who had been killed in combat, Vietnamese, cut their ears off and made a little string of it. That's not inconsistent with the sort of person who might get high on drugs and go ahead and kill some people with an ice pick.
But if Greg did it, he didn't do it alone. Jeff had described 4 people. Private investigator Ray Shedlick needed to find the others.
Ray Shedlick found witnesses who had seen a group gathered together in a diner, a group of people identical to that which Jeff described.
So those witnesses whom I could corroborate, they were the credible witnesses who I would use and forward their reports out to Mr. O'Neill.
I noticed 4 hippie-type people. They appeared to be high on something.
The black man had his arm around the white female. The males were all clean cut.
He was wearing an army fatigue jacket and dark civilian pants. There was a white man, but I didn't get a good look at him.
Army fatigues and clean cut. They sounded like ex-soldiers. Like Greg Mitchell. But these witnesses had also seen a woman with blonde hair wearing a memorable hat.
It was 3 young men and a woman in a floppy hat.
She was wearing a floppy hat and boots.
An off-white floppy brim hat, a 3/4-length vinyl coat, and clean white boots.
You might remember a woman from episode 2, known to wear a blonde wig, a floppy hat, and boots. Her name was Elena Stokely. When she testified at Jeffrey McDonald's murder trial, she said she couldn't remember a thing.
If I could remember, I would say.
Brian O'Neill needed to talk to Elena. So he and Shedlick flew to North Carolina to meet the mystery woman in the floppy hat.
Ladies and gentlemen, the seatbelt sign will be switched off shortly.
From prison, Jeff wrote to Joe McGinnis to tell him the good news.
Dear Joe, I'm on edge this weekend. Brian O. and the new investigator are in North Carolina. I somehow feel this trip is critical.
Thank you for flying.
line with us, ladies and gentlemen.
Jeff's lawyer, Brian O'Neill, and private detective Ray Shedlick had spent months reinvestigating the McDonald murders, trying to track down the hippie intruders Jeff said murdered his family. Now they arrived in North Carolina to meet the mystery woman who they thought might finally confess, Helena Stokely.
I remember one thing. It was a gorgeous area, and she was sort of nuts. She was spacey. She seemed wary. My take on her was, she's probably exactly the same sort of person who would do this.
I had a floppy hat that I used to wear all the time.
This is the real Helena Stokely, talking about the night of the McDonald murders.
I had on boots that night, and before we left, before I dropped the mescaline, I was already smoking marijuana and everything. And as a joke, I put on the blonde wig that belonged to my roommate. At the time of the murders, I was involved with the satanic cult. If I went in, my part in the whole thing would be initiation. I entered the house with another member of the cult. We had to struggle with the door, which is the reason I lit the candle to begin with. There were three members in there already talking to Dr. McDonald. He was on the couch.
What the hell are you people doing in my house?
I thought they were simply asking for drugs
or something like that. As it turns out, it turned into violence. I said, leave him alone. Someone knocked him unconscious. After that, I went into the back bedroom. That's when I saw two other members in there. Collette was struggling with them. Started screaming something like, why are you letting them do this to me, or something like that. There was a child laying on the bed next to her that I presumed was asleep, but she was bleeding profusely by that time. I said, let's leave her alone, that this was unnecessary, and someone called me up. Do-gooder or something. I'd already been called a goody-goody two-shoes in the front living room. I went back out front, and by that time, Dr. McDonald had regained consciousness, and someone was in there beating him. I said, acid is groovy, kill the pigs, hit him again, 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 again.
I first met her in the Hangout section of Fayetteville. She was running with a group of motorcycle riders.
This is Prince Beasley. He was a local narcotics detective at the time of the McDonald murders. He died many years ago, but we found this interview.
That's how I first became associated with Helena. She was young, and she impressed me as being a lonely young lady looking for attention and association with something.
Helena was just 17 when she became Beasley's drug informant.
And she was being initiated into this satanic cult, which she called a black cult. She explained to me that they would go into this ritual room. They'd hang a cat up by his hind legs and then take a knife and slit his throat. Then they would get down in this blood to rub it all over him, using their LSD or whatever drug. Then they would go into what they call a sex ritual. As men and women together, that's what they did. So I asked her if they did humans that way. Later on, she did say that humans had been sacrificed. But she wouldn't elaborate on that.
Said, Helena told Beasley about the leader of the cult, an ex-soldier just back from Vietnam.
She told me that if you ever stop him, don't let him get behind you. Don't ever turn your back on him.
He was Helena's boyfriend.
Greg Mitchell.
Greg Mitchell.
Greg was one of the most violent ones of the group.
He kept saying, I've done something.
There's no argument about what he said. The McDonald murders, we did it.
Brian O'Neill and Ray Shedlick now knew that Helena Stokely was connected to Greg Mitchell.
here.
And Ray Shedlick was pretty excited about what they'd found.
Could you just, first of all, it's S-H-E-D.
Here he is on the phone with Bob Keeler, a reporter from Newsday.
Okay.
I came up with people who, these are grown, mature, non-drinking, non-dope people.
Right.
That have signed affidavits of what they saw.
Mm-hmm.
And without a doubt, two perpetrators have been definitely identified by all the witnesses.
All the witnesses?
All the witnesses.
And these were witnesses who saw them in the vicinity of the place that night, or what?
One saw them in the vicinity of the place. It's so dynamite, it's unbelievable.
Yes, the famous Helena Stokely.
This is Dennis Rogers. Way back in 1974, just 4 years after the McDonald murders, he was a cub reporter for a local newspaper.
I was looking for a story. I had been assigned to write a big Sunday piece.
Rogers had heard about a woman who was telling people she was in the McDonald house the night of the murders. That woman was Helena Stokely. Rogers wanted to write about Helena, but he didn't want to use her name, so he called her Miss X.
That morning, I got a phone call, and this voice said, "This is Miss X, and I'm going to kill you." That got my attention.
Rogers invited Helena to the newsroom.
We sat and talked for, gosh, an hour, 2 hours. And her story changed over time. At this point, her story was, "I didn't kill anybody, but I think I might have been there." And I said, why do you think that? And she said, "Well, I keep having these nightmares.
I keep thinking I might have been there when something happened. I've been by there, driven by there, and every time I go there, I have a panic attack. And when I get near the place,
I just feel like I have some connection to it." I said, "I tell you what, let's go out there. Let's go out to the house." And she said, "Okay," reluctantly.
Rogers drove Helena to Fort Bragg. He pulled his car to the side of the road, right in front of the McDonald house.
Now, at this point, there were still plywood on the windows. It was obviously not an inhabited house. And I pulled up and I said, "I'm turned around. Let me look at my map."
Rogers rooted around in the glove box, pretending to look for a map. But the entire time, he was watching Helena.
And she was sitting next to me, looking around, looking out the window. If I recall, she was smoking a cigarette. And she was within less than halfway from here to the street from where she says she may have been involved in a triple murder. I wanted to see her have a panic attack. You know, what kind of reaction did she really have? And there was nothing, absolutely nothing. I finally said, "I guess that's it. That must be at the house." And she looked at it and she said, "I don't recognize that one." And that was when I finally knew. I don't know who did kill him, but it was not Helena Stokely. It was all bullshit.
"Dear Jeff, God, there's some amazing stuff in what I've read. No sense ranting about it here. I've got a book to put it in. Please keep me posted on the progress made by O'Neill and investigators. The ending can be altered even after the book is set in type if there is a truly important break. At this point, you can and should tell the world, 60 Minutes, Barbara Walters, and anyone and everyone else, that the book is virtually complete. By all means, hype the book. And be sure, in any conversations about it, to get across that I have been operating with complete freedom and independence. Incidentally, or not so incidentally, the title search is finally over. The book will be called Fatal Vision."
"Joe, your letter was welcome news. Title, great. hits me with a gut-wrenching impact. It also reads well when you see it typed. The right jacket should be eye-catching. But I'm consumed with interest in your meaning of it.
Dear Jeff, the title was finally one I chose mainly on instinct and gut feeling. I'm glad you like it. I went with one I knew would work up enthusiasm and one which could operate on many different levels, as indeed it does for you, Joe.
Was Joe really going to end Fatal Vision with Helena Stokely's confession? Jeff was about to find out on national television.
MacDonald first learned of McGinnis's conclusions when I talked with him in prison, and he was devastated.
That's next week on Morally Indefensible. Morally Indefensible is a production of Truth Media in partnership with Sony Music Entertainment. This episode of Morally Indefensible was produced by Zach Hirsch and Julia Botero, with help from Ryan Swikert, Jesse Rodoy, Kevin Shepard, and Danielle Elliott. Story editing is by me, Mark Smerling, and Danielle Elliott. While Sandro Santoro is our associate producer, our archive producer is Brennan Reese, Scott Curtis is our production manager. Fact-checking by Amy Gaines. Kenny Cusiak did the music and mix, sound design by Kenny Cusiak and Zach Hirsch. Additional music by John Cusiak and Marmoset. Our title track is Promises by The Monophonics. Voice reenactments by Logan Stearns, Jesse Rodoy, Sam Bevitt, Gina DiNardo, Natalie Archer, Shelley Chenoy, Victoria Putman, Emmett Swikert, Ryan Swikert, and Zach Hirsch. Legal review by Linda Steinman and Jack Browning of Davis Wright Tremaine. Special thanks to Sean Twigg, May Ryan, Luke Malone, Brian Murphy, Joe Langford, Peter Schmuel, Diana DeCilio, Bob Stevenson, Christina Misavich, Bob Keeler, and Daryl Morris. If you'd like to continue the conversation online, find us on Instagram and Facebook at Morally Indefensible and Twitter at Morally Indef, MorallyIndef. If you've enjoyed Morally Indefensible, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes. It really helps other people find the show. And thanks for listening.